Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
He was playing rock and roll music, but he wasn't interested at all in the rock and roll lifestyle.
Greetings, everyone. Patrick Foster here, and on behalf of Jim Linehan, I want to welcome you to Rockin' the Suburbs. You have found us right in the middle of the Rye Cooter experience. This is the third episode in the series. Big thanks go out to Kurt Gallagher for his enthusiasm, his passion, his knowledge of Rye Cooter and all things guitar, finger-picking-wise and otherwise. And just feel real lucky to have Kurt as part of our group. If you listen to the first two episodes, you know that we left off yesterday with Rye Cooter at the end of the 60s, right at the beginning of the 70s. He'd been in a couple groups. He'd done a lot of session work. He's hung around with the Rolling Stones. But this is going to be the launch of his solo career here at the start of the 70s. And he was lucky enough to be on a label called Reprise Records. And you will hear Kurt talk about the philosophy behind Reprise very shortly. So stay tuned for a trip through some of the best music made in the 1970s, in my opinion, the Rye Cooter solo albums. We've got the two large reel-to-reel tape decks threaded up here and synchronized, so we're going to hit play and roll into the 1970 solo work of Rye Cooter.
Talk a little bit about how he got started on his solo career, Kurt. He was signed to Warner Brothers / Reprise, one of their subsidiaries, and it was a much more sympathetic set of music executives at that label than it was when he was with Columbia and the Rising Suns. So at least he had some sort of experience about what a bad record company deal is like and what a bad experience is, right?
Yeah, Reprise was started by Frank Sinatra in 1960. And he started Reprise to create a record company that gave artists artistic freedom. And that's what Reprise was all about, artistic freedom. At a certain point, Reprise was folded into Warner Brothers. And I think Rye, it was still Reprise maybe when Rye's first album came out, but it's usually talked about him being on Warner Brothers. But you know what? The artistic freedom continued with Warner Brothers. They had Randy Newman, Van Dyke Parks, Rye Cooter, and they were just letting these guys do whatever they felt like doing, which was amazing.
Yeah.
lasted the whole decade of the 70s. They were not putting any pressure on him to make hits. They're just like, do your thing, Rye. We love it. You know, we love musicians. We love, you know, what you guys come up with, and we're here to support you. And it was like, that doesn't exist anymore. And it probably didn't exist much then either, but they were in this bubble in Los Angeles with this Warner Brothers company that just gave artists lots of freedom to do what they wanted to do. It did pay off at the end of the 70s, but it was pretty rough, you know, for
right.
sales.
Yeah. But
he made some great records that way though. He did what he wanted to do.
And he found and unearthed some unbelievable songs that, just like you were saying about the music that he must have been playing in his house or he heard when he was growing up with his parents' hootenannies and listening to the Harry Smith compilation and all of this stuff. He found this music that's like at the very seams of the American vernacular. It's just incredible where this stuff comes from. His first album, Rye Cooter, has... it was one of the later Rye Cooter albums I got, but I've come to treasure it like hardly any other album I have. And it's just got some of the most amazing music. I remember when I discovered it, and at the time it was probably I don't know. We had little kids, and my wife and I were going out to eat with her family, and I dropped them all off at the front, you know, the restaurant. I was going to park the car and come in, but I sat in the car and listened to "How Can a Poor Man Stand Such Times and Live" over and over like five times before I went in.
Tell me about it.
Started a string of really remarkable records. Where do you come in to the Reichhuder story? When did you first get into them?
When I was a kid in high school, I was reading Cream magazine and Rolling Stone and whatever, you know. But I saw ads for his albums, but I'd never heard his albums. And my brother didn't have any Reichhuder albums. So I was aware of him, and I knew that one of his albums, Bop Till You Drop, was the first digitally recorded albums, and that was sort of big news in rock and roll at the end of the 70s. But I didn't really get into him until I started going to those guitar seminars and really getting into acoustic finger-picking guitar. I was a moderator of a really busy guitar forum, you know, before social media was a thing. We had these like bulletin boards and forums. Woody Mann and Bob Brosman had a forum that was really popular, and they asked me to be the moderator, and his name would come up all the time.
I bet. Yeah.
And also, I became a really big fan of Joseph Spence when I got into acoustic guitar in the 90s. Joseph Spence is one of my favorite guitar players of all time, and he's really popular with other acoustic guitar players. He's just the best. People love him so much, and we'll talk about him a lot more, but I had heard that there were some Joseph Spence tracks on these 70s Reichhuder albums, so I started then I started looking for these albums. I wanted to hear his take on Joseph Spence, and he recorded a lot of Spence tunes. So yeah, that's how I got to Rye, was through Spence and just this guitar forum that I was part of. I think my first album was Paradise and Lunch, which I loved right away.
Yeah.
Right away.
Well, it's really funny. I was going to tell the very quick story. I had a girlfriend in high school who's our main thing, well, you know, that we did during this brief relationship was she had two younger siblings, and her parents would go out to dinner, and we would stay home and watch, you know, the younger siblings, which really meant put them to bed as soon as possible, steal beer from the fridge, and go through his album collection. And one of the albums he had in there was Paradise and Lunch, and that's the first time I ever heard a Reichhuder record. Yeah, that was a pretty popular one for him. But this guy, he had a good record collection, because I remember he had Joan Baez and The Clash in there too, among others. So it was a good record collection.
Yeah, if he had everything between Joan Baez and The Clash, that is a good record collection.
So I gotta credit him for that. Also had Like to Drink Genesee Cream Ale. So that's beer that we would steal. Hey, yeah.
I'm from Pennsylvania, man. I grew up on Jenny Cream Ale. It's a green can that turns your insides green also.
That's right. Yeah, it is. It's great. How would you characterize, I guess, the approach that Rye took on these albums? He was a lot of times working with songs he unearthed, you know, like the historian type of him servicing these songs, and yet putting these incredible arrangements on them. He was doing a lot of the singing on these tracks as well. And it's hard to describe that they just had this feeling like they came up from the earth, like they always have been there. And I treasure them for that.
I think he was really into economics and history, and he knew a lot about the Depression from the records that he listened to. And he was bringing these folk ballads from the Depression, and he was resurfacing them with some crunchy guitar. On his first album, you know, right away with Alimony, he's just, you can hear the crunch on his guitar. He's playing rock and roll, but he's choosing these old songs. There's a run of three songs on his first album that just kills me every time I listen to it. It starts out with My Old Kentucky Home. No, wait, yes. No, it's Do Re Mi comes first, which is 1940 Woody Guthrie, and then My Old Kentucky Home, which is 1852 Stephen Foster. And then How Can a Poor Man Stand Such Times and Live, which you mentioned, which just kills me. I love that song so much. It's become, I think it's my, right now, if you ask me what my favorite song is, I'd have to say that, because I'm, as research for this, I've been listening to lots of different versions and all his different versions. And it just, every time I hear it, it kills me every time. And that was 1929 by Blind Alfred Reed. And it could have been written last week. Some of the words are different, but I mean, the sentiment about the economics and how brutal it is on normal folk, you know, that it's happening right now.
Yeah, it really, really is. It's unbelievable.
I can't wait. In a couple weeks, I'm going to sing that song at an open mic. I just got together with a buddy and we played that song for about an hour at a park last week. So yeah, I love that song. But there's those three songs on his first album, just, and he's got crunchy guitar on, especially Do Re Mi, the Woody Guthrie, and the Old Kentucky Home. There's some new lyrics that were written by Randy Newman in My Old Kentucky Home, but still it's a song from 1852 by Stephen Foster.
It is.
He's turning it into a rock and roll song. And I love it so much. So much.
Turpentine and dandelion wine. I've turned the corner and I'm doing fine. Shooting at the birds on the telephone line. Picking them off with this gun of mine. Got a fire in my belly and a fire in my head. Going higher and higher till I'm dead. Sister Sue was short and stout and she didn't grow up, she grew out. Papa says she's plain, but he's just being kind. Mama says she's pretty, but she's shines bright on my old Kentucky home, and the young folks roll on the floor. The sun shines bright on my old Kentucky home, keep them hard times away from my door. Brother Gene was big and mean, and he didn't have much to say.
I would give a shout out to the album cover. And like you said, the artistic freedom. I mean, Rye is like leaning up against an Airstream trailer and there's like a neon Rye Cooter. You know, it couldn't speak more to like a wandering spirit.
Yeah, and they're out in the desert.
The American West. Yeah, yeah, amazing.
His wife is a photographer and she took most of the pictures on his album covers. And she's in the picture that's on the next album, the second album, Into the Purple Valley. So I guess she didn't take that picture, but she's in it. But she took most of the other pictures. There's a song on side two of his first album where he does a cover of Blind Blake's Police Dog Blues.
Yeah.
And if you ever wanted to hear like what Blind Blake would sound like with modern recording techniques, listen to that, because he plays it note for note, sings it really well, and it's he plays the Blind Blake guitar part perfectly, and
yeah, it's
recorded really well. So if you want to know what Blind Blake would sound like today, just listen to that on his first album.
All my life I've been a driving man. All my life I've been a driving man. Staying alone and doing the best I can. I ship my trunk down to Tennessee. Ship my trunk down to Tennessee. It's hard to tell about a man like me.
A great point about the way these records are recorded. There's a richness about them even today that really holds up. It was clean and clear, yet the players are all really, really good, and they blended really well together, and it's just a joy to hear this music now. You mentioned Into the Purple Valley. In this record, you know, you start to hear a little bit of his expansion into some styles of music that came from outside the United States. There's the song FDR in Trinidad you highlighted, right? It's got almost a kind of steel band feel to it. And he's slowly letting his tendrils creep out as this album unfolds, right?
Yeah, he's getting into some island stuff, which is going to become really important later in his career. He has two songs in this album that are his first adventure into the islands, which is FDR in Trinidad, which is a calypso. And then he does Great Dreams from Heaven by Joseph Spence, who was from the Bahamas. That's another one I got really early, because I definitely wanted to hear that Spence stuff. But yeah, the whole island stuff and just going out and looking for new types of music were a big theme of his whole career.
So talk a little bit more about Mission Paradise and Lunch, but there's also Boomer's Story, the title track of which is really good. In 1972, he put out two records, and then he had Paradise and Lunch in 74. How would you characterize this period that builds up to the mid-70s, where he takes a little bit of a left turn?
Yeah, just more of the same, much better. But on his second album, he did make a couple changes. Jim Dickinson found out about Rye and really wanted to work with him. So he went out to L.A. and arranged a meeting, and he started working with Rye. And for that whole run of albums in the 70s, after the debut, Jim Dickinson was the piano guy and did a lot of arrangements. He's, you know, from Muscle Shoals and did all the soul stuff with Aretha. Yep. Probably with the Stones, too, in Muscle Shoals. But
yeah,
he's a legend. He's a legend. You can go down a Jim Dickinson rabbit hole for sure.
You can.
And he started working with... Ding, 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 Jim Keltner, the connection to all things music.
Right.
Jim Keltner started playing with him, and they played together on everything after that first album. So it was Jim Dickinson and Jim Keltner for the rest of the 70s. Oh, and Chris Etheridge from the Flying Burrito Brothers.
Right, yeah.
Was the bass player. And he added a couple... he added a George Bohannon on horns. If you ever listen to the Tom Tom Club song called Genius of Love, they go, Bohannon. That's George Bohannon, because he played saxophone and trombone. He was a horn guy, trumpet. He played all the reeds.
I never knew where that came from.
Yeah, that's George Bohannon. He's a famous reed guy and brass guy. He also added a couple new singers. On his first album, he had female backup singers. His backup singing is always so good.
It is.
It's like really gospel-influenced background singing, and he always had the best background singers. I'm not sure if it was Boomer Story or Paradise and Lunch, but he added three male background singers. Mm. Terry Evans and Bobby King were always there, but the third seat changed from album to album. But Terry Evans and Bobby King worked with Rye a lot, and he produced albums for them later in the 80s, and they went on to big careers of their own, but he started working with them, I think, on Paradise and Lunch. So he had the male background singers and this other sort of band that he was putting together, because Dickinson, Keltner, and Etheridge were on most of his albums in the 70s, and George Bohannon was always there too. So he was just rolling with the changes, but doing more of the same as far as the material, digging for little nuggets from the past, economics and blues and history. And he never did, like, they weren't asking him for hits, so he wasn't doing, like, silly love songs. You know, he wrote about male-female relations and, like, sexual politics, and he was digging for stuff in the blues, but he never wrote, like, a love song that could have been a hit on the radio. And he just wasn't interested in that. He wasn't interested in the rock and roll lifestyle either. He was just interested in music.
Right.
He talks about going to bed at 9 o'clock, you know, and just getting up and making music the next day. But he wasn't interested in going to hotel rooms and, you know, the drugs and the sex and all that goes with being a rock star. He was playing rock and roll music, but he wasn't interested at all in the rock and roll lifestyle. Like I said, he's had the same wife his whole life. And so he's just he's a working music guy who goes home at the end of the day.
Which is pretty amazing. It really is. Another reason that he's kind of an anomaly in the world of rock and roll music, yet made such great rock and roll. On his next album, Chicken Skin Music, he kind of takes a little bit of a turn into Mexican Norteño music, something like that. There's a couple tracks with one of my favorite musicians, or somebody who came to be one of my favorite musicians, Flaco Jimenez, on the accordion, who's just immense. And also, I got to say, the cover of Chicken Skin Music is something you have to look at, folks, because when you look at it at first, it just looks like a skeleton sitting in an alleyway, but it's not.
Take a closer look.
Yeah, it's really great. This was one of my favorites, and it may be one of his most eclectic or eccentric, depending on how you want to put it, but it's got Stand By Me, that's done as kind of a Mexican waltz kind of a thing. That Stand By Me, and it's really a cool record. I just really like it. There's even some Hawaiian type stuff on this too. It's he really kind of starts sprawling on this one, I think.
Yeah, he was getting into Hawaiian stuff, but he said he heard some Tex-Mex, which can be Norteño or Tejano, or just Tex-Mex. He heard an accordion player on the radio, and he had never heard this accordion-driven Tex-Mex music before for some reason. But he reached out to Arhuli Records up in San Francisco. He had a friend that owned Arhuli, and he said, "I heard this thing on the radio. It was accordion and one 12-string guitar and two singers singing in harmony." And he's like, "It's the greatest thing I've ever heard. What is that?" And he's like, "Come up and see me. I have 10,000 records of this stuff."
Oh, wow.
And he and his wife actually got on a plane the next day and flew up to San Francisco and went to Arhuli. And he wasn't lying. He actually had thousands of records of this Tex-Mex Tejano music.
Wow.
And Rye learned, after this experience, he learned how to play the accordion. He taught himself how to play accordion.
Wow.
And then he went down to, it's like, this was happening like San Antonio, like on the Texas-Mexico border is where this music was happening. And he went around to meet these players and these accordion players, and he showed Flaco Jimenez what he could do on accordion because he taught himself. And Flaco Jimenez was so inspired by that, or was so impressed by that, that he agreed to work with Rye on this, on Chicken Skin Music.
That's just an incredible story. It really is.
Not anyone can just pick up and start playing an accordion and 2 years later go down and play for some of the best players in the world.
If you've ever picked up an accordion, for one thing, those things are freaking heavy, man. And there are about 49,000 buttons and keys on it, which is incredible too. I mean,
I guess the Germans brought
once, and I couldn't believe it.
Germans brought accordions to southern Texas and Mexico, and they actually, polka and German music became meshed in with Mexican music. It's a crazy story how that happened. But yeah, that whole accordion thing with Flaco Jimenez, Rye was really inspired by that. There's a song on Chicken Skin Music, tell him he'll have to go. Put your sweet lips a little closer to the phone. I used to hear that song on some corny country record commercial in the 70s.
Yeah.
I was like, what? Oh, is Jim Reeves sang that, the original hit? But Rye does a version, really nice Tex-Mex version of that on Chicken Skin Music.
Your sweet lips a little closer to the phone, and let's pretend that we're together all alone. I'll tell the man to turn the jukebox.
Say the words I want to hear when you're The record ends with a version of Goodnight Irene, the Lead Belly song, too. Man. So you can't get any weirder than that. It's amazing.
Now,
there was a tour that was called the Chicken Skin Music Tour, I think, or the Chicken Skin Tour, that took place in 1976 across the U.S. And Flaco Jimenez played the accordion in the band, which is pretty incredible. Rye on the electric guitar. There was the vocalist you mentioned, Pat Rizzo playing horns, Isaac Garcia on drums, and there's a live album that came out with this called Showtime. So yeah. If you want to get a flavor of what kind of music they were making and how Rye Cooder would translate an album into a tour, actually, I'm not even sure if any of the songs on Chicken Skin Music actually appear on the live album. Maybe Smack Dab in the Middle is one, but I think that might be the only one.
That's so, on there.
Yeah, they were just moving. It was just moving in, you know, an incredible direction at this time. So it's definitely worth seeking out if you can find the live album, Showtime. I picked it up in the used bin one time for about $7. So if you can find it, keep your eye out.
On the main line, tell him what you want.
Oh, Jesus on the main line,
tell him what you want.
Well, it's Jesus on the main line,
tell him what you want.
You can call him up and tell him what you want,
what you want.
Well, the line ain't never busy,
tell him what you want.
Well, that line ain't never busy,
tell him what you want.
The line ain't never busy, tell him what you want.
You can call him up and tell him what you want, what you want.
Get away.
Tell him what you want.
Well, if you're sick and you wanna get well, tell him what you want. But if you're sick and you wanna get well,
tell him what you want.
You can call him up and tell him what you want.
And by the time 1978 rolls around, he's making an album called Jazz.
Yeah, he takes a total left turn. He does a mostly instrumental, like early jazz record. He met a couple producers who are into the idea, and he's like, yeah, let's try that. Why not? You know, I have artistic freedom. I'll do what I want.
Unbelievable.
It's so weird because it came before his biggest selling album of all time, yeah. He recovered, you know, but it was definitely a left turn. And he doesn't really talk very highly of this album, but I actually like it a lot.
I like it a lot too. Yeah. It's not the jazz of, you know, Miles Davis or even Charlie Parker. It's the jazz of Jelly Roll Morton and, you know, Vic Picardy. It's going way back. There are two Joseph Spence adaptions on this that he does versions of too. So you get your Rye Cooder in amongst your Jelly Roll Morton.
Well, in the town of Louisville, they got a man they call Big Bad Bill. I want to tell you He sure was tough, and he certainly did strut his stuff. He had folks all scared to death. When they walked by, they held their breath. He was a fighting man, sure enough. Now Bill's took himself a wife, and he leads a different life. Cause Big Bad Bill is Sweet William now. Married life has changed him somehow. Well, he's a man that they all used to fear, but now the people call him Sweet Papa Willie Dear. Stronger than Samson, I declare, till the brown skinned mama bobbed his hair. Big Bad Bill don't fight anymore. Well, he washes dishes and he mops up the floor. Well, he used to spend his evenings looking for a fight. Now he's got to see his mama every night. Big Bad Bill is Sweet William now.
Album, it's different, and that's definitely one you can find if you keep your eyes peeled in the used bins. You can usually come across a copy of that. Anything that Ry Cooter made, if you find it in the used bins, I would suggest buying it. I really would. So tell us a little bit more. You mentioned it earlier in passing, the LP Bop Till You Drop. I did not know that it was one of the first, if not the first, digitally recorded album.
It was the first digitally recorded pop or rock album. It wasn't his idea, though. Somebody at Warner Brothers said, you know, we have access to this new technology, and why don't we use it? Why don't we make a record? And he said, yeah, I'm always up for something. So it was the first digitally recorded album. And what was that? 1979. Yeah. So this was way before, like, CDs started coming out.
Way before.
At least probably four or five years before CDs hit the marketplace. But they had digital recording gear in Los Angeles, and they went in and made a record. And it became, I don't think it be because of that. I mean, that got a lot of people talking, but it became his best-selling album. It had a great cover, nice colors. Yep. And I think maybe Warner Brothers might have done a little bit of a push behind that album. It's like a last gasp. Okay, Ry, you know, you've been doing your thing for 10 years now. Let's try to sell a couple records. So he did a version of Little Sister, which, you know, was played on the radio a little bit. And Chaka Khan came in and did a couple duets with Ry.
That's right.
Yeah, really good stuff with Chaka Khan. And it's a great sounding record. He sort of disparages it. He thinks that it sounded great in the studio, but the mastering wasn't so great. I'm sure they fixed that by now, but yeah, it is a really good sounding record. You can really hear everybody on that record, and I enjoy it. It's great.
I like it a lot too. I really do. And like I said, you have favorites and songs that were, you know, jumped out at you over his 70s albums, but I think all of them are worth listening to, and all of them have at least three or four songs that are worth your time and effort to listen to. I just think it's an amazing period of rock and roll that, you know, like you were saying, kind of ran in parallel to everything else that was happening. You know, it wasn't the excess of 70s arena rock. It wasn't AM gold. It wasn't any of that stuff. It was just,
it wasn't disco. It wasn't punk.
It wasn't disco at all. It wasn't punk. You know, it was more interested in 1930 than 1980.
It's fascinating. He wasn't playing disco or punk, but I think of him as kind of a punk rocker because he was just doing what he wanted to do.
Yeah, that's very true.
He was a rebel, and he just had that, I'm going to do it. It wasn't really DIY because he had this company behind him, but his whole idea was like, I'm going to do what I'm going to do, and we're going to record it the best that we possibly can. I have all these ideas. I'm going to get these people together that, you know, that understand what I'm thinking, and we're just going to record these songs, and we're going to bring them back. And that's why I think he's kind of a punk rocker, because of his he wasn't trying to please anybody, and he was just doing, he was just following his muse.
I totally agree with that, and I think that's as much the spirit of punk as anybody. I mean, and obviously he was a little DIY. I mean, he taught himself the accordion. So there you go. He didn't need like a lot of lessons and stuff. He could teach himself.
Okay, that was Don't Mess Up a Good Thing from the 1979 LP Bop Till You Drop on the Warner Brothers label. As mentioned, the first album to be recorded all digitally, and really a fascinating record, and it did pretty well for Riot. Sold a decent amount of copies and kept his career in a good place. So just incredible music from the 1970s. And as I mentioned a couple times, keep your eyes peeled on those used bins, because you can often go some way toward completing your Cooter 70s collection if you just keep your eyes peeled. They're often floating around in the used bins. Next up on tomorrow's episode, we'll get into the 1980s, a little more solo work, and then a really fascinating development in Rye's career. He began to create soundtracks for films, and took him to a whole different place. Let's play out with a song that was mentioned early in the episode by Kurt, but we didn't get around to playing it, and that song is off his self-titled debut album from 1970. The song is Alimony. So we'll take you out with that and say to you, we will talk to you with much, much more Rye Cooter tomorrow.
Look at this one, look at that one. Them he do, they look like me. All my friends said, don't you worry, still have testify for me. Well, I wonder which of my friends had it been for me. Children, when ain't but two that look like me. Please have mercy, judge your honor, alimony, killing me.
I'm from Pennsylvania, man. I grew up on Jenny Cream Ale.